My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, a podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most. Because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success. I've been telling everybody that our government is shady. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with your...
Mark being Mark again.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know? If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You know, just tell your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
I think that it probably is not a stretch of the imagination to say that when we look at the United States and the religion, that quite clearly the idea of apocalypse has been running through our national history for a long time. And I think definitely... at the end of the Civil War was seen as apocalyptic. You know, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, you know, the battle hymn of the Republic. And when the Civil War ended and people were trying to make sense of what had happened, and again, this is, you know, a complex issue, I think that this is also a point where you started seeing some of the splits. Like I said, there's really two kind of apocalyptic approaches, premillennialism and postmillennialism. But one of them, like I said before, is that we have to clear out sin in order for Jesus to come back. And then the other one is like, there's just no saving us. So why even bother? Just let Jesus come and wipe it all out and start all over again.
You just heard today's guest, host of Rebel Spirit Radio, who joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this conversation with Nick Mather. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. And joining me today is a guest who has a podcast of his own and a background in philosophy, mysticism. We're going to be talking about a lot of fascinating stuff with today's guest, host of Rebel Spirit Radio, Dr. Nick Mather. He's joining us for the first time on the show. Mather. Sorry.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you, Nick. Welcome to the show. For folks who are just learning about Rebel Spirit Radio, give us a background on how you started the program and what inspired it.
Sure. First, thank you for having me here. I've been looking forward to this. I really appreciate this opportunity. Rebel Spirit Radio, I began almost 4 years ago. And one of the things that I really was hoping to do is to take my background, this vast educational background, and put it to good use. So the podcast focuses on spirituality, consciousness, psychedelics, the esoteric, and there's also an environmental aspect. I always phrase it as looking at humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So I really wanted to be able to open up these conversations to a much larger audience. And right now, what I mostly do is interview authors about their books along these topics. But I'm hoping to make some changes here and kind of branch off into some different types of content for the podcast.
Really? Okay. Yeah, I'm excited to see what that becomes. And you have interviewed dozens and dozens of fascinating people, some folks that we've had on this show as well. And yeah, I'm expecting us to have a lot in common just off that alone. But yeah, for folks who are curious about Rebel Spirit Radio, you guys cover a lot of the same topics. And from that earth-oriented lens, which I really appreciate because, you know, it does feel like there have been some major splits ideologically over the past decade or so, at least in my adult life. And I remember when I was younger, what was sort of fringe and taboo has now sort of flipped around, and some of the things that were fringe and taboo are a little bit more mainstream. And I guess to be more accurate, it feels like the mainstreaming of cannabis and psychedelics has lost a little bit of its green edge that it once had. And I'm curious what you think of that, you know, considering psychedelics and philosophy have a sort of backdoor relationship with each other in a way. You know, they sort of, it seems a lot of philosophers have enjoyed, you know, the access that psychedelics give you to another state of mind. So yeah, what are your thoughts on that as someone who's a philosopher and talks to a lot of people who are experts in this subject?
Yeah, I agree that there's been a loss to some extent, especially in regards to the commercialization, I think, of these substances. And it seems to me that we're missing something that is spiritual in many aspects. The focus, especially on psychedelics, has been on the therapeutic idea. And I think that that's probably necessary the same way that it was necessary to start getting cannabis legalized. You know, the first movement, of course, was for the medicinal cannabis. And that's how we got to where we are with, I think, half of the states now have legalized cannabis for recreational purposes. And I think that psychedelics are taking a very similar route. My concern with the psychedelics is, you know, of course, the commercialization. When, you know, venture capitalists get involved, sometimes that leads to things that aren't the best. And as I said, I think that it misses the point of view from those who just want to use them for spiritual purposes, for self-exploration. That aspect hasn't really been addressed that much. We're starting to see some places decriminalize psychedelics. I'm in Denver, and Colorado decriminalized psilocybin and DMT, I think peyote. I think that's about the extent of it. And then various cities, I think like Oakland and California, has done the same. And it's, in a sense, it's a wild open space, you know, in Colorado. I think we just opened our first psilocybin treatment center. And where this is going to go, I don't know. But I also think that there is a concern that it's becoming popular, and especially things with microdosing. And I've had personal experience of knowing some people who were running wellness clinics, and this was in California. And were reaching out to some of their clients sort of secretly saying, hey, we have these things that you might be interested in. And they were gouging people and advertising things that weren't true. And it seemed to me that, you know, because it's popular, people may not know if they don't have the background, if they don't have the experience, they may not know if they're being taken advantage of. Because the education about these substances really has been limited to, you know, therapists and Just Say No. And so I think that there needs to be more conversations about what people can legitimately expect, and hopefully to also help people avoid getting taken advantage of.
Yeah, I think it's in front and center in America's very complex religious culture, which, you know, arguably, I think the majority of people, their, you know, 30-second answer, what religion is America? They would say Christian. But as you know, and I know, there is a much more complicated story. And I found from looking back in your YouTube channel, some of the first videos you posted, you mentioned your own familial connections to the Mather family, which Cotton Mather might be a famous name that people recognize. I've been researching Yale University and Harvard, trying to sort of piece together some what I think are missing pieces in America's story. And one of the really fascinating things that I learned is that there were characters like John Winthrop the Younger, an alchemist who was mixing potions, and at the same time the governor of the colony of Connecticut. So, you know, these things that we think of now as fringe and counterculture seem to be right there at the beginning of what we think of as, you know, American culture and how it started. So, where, when we look back at the colonial culture, you know, what are some examples? Because you have these two videos, American Religion Part 1 and 2. And this was probably a couple years before Ronnie Pontiac put his book out, American Metaphysical Religion, which I know you interviewed Ronnie and you're probably aware of that book. But it seems like now, with maybe psychedelics and cannabis in particular becoming more commonplace, we're seeing, I don't know, maybe the generalization of this, or just the acceptance of this sort of thing that's always really been a part of American culture, this sort of, you know, illicit drug use, I guess would be the most general way to put it.
Yeah. You know, I don't know how much prior to the 1960s, I don't know how much use there was in terms of cannabis and psilocybin. I imagine that it occurred. But you're absolutely right that there has been this ongoing trajectory in the American religious tradition that is non-traditional, you know, not Christian. Right now, and I think this has leveled off just a little bit for the past 10 years, the fastest growing demographic, religious demographic in the United States has been people who identify as spiritual but not religious. So we're starting to see people leaving the church in droves. And there's probably a variety of reasons for that. One, just, you know, basic troubles that the churches have had, controversies both, you know, in Catholicism and in the Protestant tradition as well. And it seems that there's something that traditional spirituality is not necessarily speaking to these days. And I think that psychedelics can actually help in that regards. One of the people that I interviewed, and I would love to talk to him again, was Hunt Priest. And Hunt he's an Episcopalian priest, and he participated in psilocybin studies at Johns Hopkins. And he's got a mission now where he is trying to open up this realm of psychedelics to a, for him, a Christian audience. He began an organization called Legere, and Legere comes out of the root for the word religion, because religion literally means to rebind or to reconnect. And the question, of course, is, well, to what? You know, and most people will say, well, but to God. But you can also make the case that you're reconnecting to something else. There's always the questions of, well, what do you mean by God in the first place? We can make a case that, you know, reconnect to the earth is a religious experience, or reconnect to a greater sense of self. You know, so my understanding is that where, when psychedelics were really in the forefront in the 50s and 60s, really what happened was that's when we started seeing an explosion of people finding interest in Asian traditions. And they turned to the Asian traditions to make sense of what they were experiencing under, you know, LSD or psilocybin. And it seemed to make more sense to them than the traditional Christian or Western traditions. And it's also when we started seeing the development of the, like, the New Age movement, which kind of pick and chooses from different traditions in many ways. And I think at its heart, there's also this sort of psychedelic core. So I'm really curious how, with this psychedelic renaissance that we're going through, how that might affect American religion. Because as you noted, this is not, you know, people like to say it's a Christian nation, and it's not. It may be a nation of Christians, for the most part. But, you know, we're in really interesting times. And I hope that this trajectory kind of continues. I would like to see a little bit more secularization of the nation, rather than this small but vocal and powerful Christian groups having a stranglehold on the religious ideas of the nation. And I think that there's room to hope that that's kind of letting go. I think that maybe that form of Christianity is having its last hurrah. And we're going to end up someplace very different, probably by the end of the 21st century. And where that is, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the current political divide that we're seeing has a sort of spiritual basis behind it? It almost seems like that might be at the heart of a lot of the conflict we're seeing. Ideologically, there might be Christians on both sides, but there seems to be a different approach to this argument that maybe we didn't experience in the past as a nation. And you could maybe blame the internet and social media for that. But yeah, it does kind of feel like there's almost a split now, to where, you know, traditional conservative versus liberal and progressive have also kind of taken up the helms of Christianity and atheism, which in the past it maybe wasn't such a pronounced split. It might have been more, you know, Christian versus Christian, or, you know, what have you, different denominations of Christianity. But yeah, it seems like we are kind of broaching a point where a group of people in the country don't have a lot of respect for spirituality, because they feel like it's getting in the way of what they see as progress.
To some extent, yeah. I think that there's a complicated answer to all of this, I think. And I don't know that it's an answer, but background, perhaps, of where we are now, at least how I understand it. And I also should probably interject here. When you introduced me, you know, I've got the background in philosophy, but I also have a background in religious studies. And my doctorates in philosophy and religion. And my doctoral work was largely in the American political and religious traditions. So I sort of followed that trajectory. What I want to say in response is that the history, as I see it, is this. You know, at the start of the revolution, the statistics that we have are that 17% of Americans identified with the church. Now, that I think is shocking to a lot of people, because we have this story of the Puritans and the Pilgrims coming over, but they weren't the first ones. You know, this began as a colony. It began as a corporate colony, and they just took advantage of that. And there was a role for religion in the foundation of the country. But this wasn't founded as a Christian nation by any stretch of the imagination. By the time of the beginning of the Civil War, that 17% really hadn't changed. One of the ways of looking at that is because the nation was a frontier and people were, you know, just moving westward. There wasn't a lot of large cities. People were largely separated. We had a couple of what are referred to as great awakenings. And especially after the revolution and the adoption of the Constitution, that would be the second great awakening. And that was featured with like tent revivals, right? And it was very Protestant because anyone could be a religious leader. And it was after the Civil War that you started seeing American Christians, because, you know, identifying with churches. Partly, I think that's because you start having cities. We start having larger cities. And once you have larger cities and urban areas and people are settled and they're not pushing westward all the time, then they're going to start identifying with churches. But there was this really interesting phenomena that happened, and this is part of kind of religious history in general, that's called the higher criticism. And this comes out of Germany. And it was people began questioning the authorship of the biblical texts. Traditionally, like the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, the first five books, which are the Torah, tradition was that Moses wrote them, right? But scholars began questioning that, and that's been questioned for a very long time. But this higher criticism really said, okay, yeah, Moses could not possibly have written these. And people began saying, okay, well, you know, we can't see this now as the inerrant word of God. This seems to have been a hodgepodge, a collection of writings. Now, most theologians in the United States were trained in that. Many of them were. So, for example, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who's associated with the Unitarians, you know, he knew about this. You know, so this started in the mid-1800s. And what also happened at this point was a focus of, well, if the Old Testament is not, you know, word for word dictated by God, well, what can we know about the New Testament? And the New Testament, you started getting people focusing not on Jesus as a divine being, but on the teachings of Jesus. And that created what's known as the social gospel. And the social gospel was a gospel that focused, you know, there would be a group of people now who would absolutely hate this because they would say it's all woke, but it was the social justice teachings of Jesus. And this is where you started seeing things like Hull House and in Chicago and various other movements. It had good parts and bad parts. Prohibition was grounded in the social gospel. It was also an apocalyptic movement in the sense of, and I always get this wrong, but there's two strains of apocalyptic thought. And one of them is that we need to make everything good before Jesus returns. And so we have to fix everything. And the social gospel was rooted in that. It was actually referred to at the time as a social Christian socialism. It was very influential. The main book, the author was Walter Rauschenbusch, and I forget the title, has social gospel in it, was the best-selling book for 3 years in the United States, second only to the Bible. What happened was World War II. And at the end of World War II, you also had the Great Depression. And what FDR did with the New Deal, much of that was grounded in social gospel ideas. But you had business leaders who hated it. They absolutely hated that. And they wanted to dismantle all the New Deal policies. And so what happened was this very intentional movement to get people to vote for candidates that would dismantle the New Deal. But the New Deal was really popular. And the way to do that, though, was to get people focused on social issues. One of the very first social issues was prayer in public schools. There had been a Supreme Court ruling banning forced prayer in public schools. And that was one of the very first things that they looked at. And then there was segregation. And then there was abortion. And this was an ongoing process that led to the creation of the moral majority in the U.S. And I think that you start seeing your split probably at the time of World War, at the end of World War II. People like Martin Luther King Jr. was very influenced by the social gospel, and that informed the civil rights movement. But then you started having this group that began, you know, their attention was put onto the social issues. And you had politicians that were running on these social issues, but the whole agenda was to get rid of the New Deal policies. And you have to add to this mix this other branch of Christian fundamentalism that was a response to the social gospel. It was a response to evolution, and evolution being taught in schools. And that has gotten us really to where we are now. And it's that second group that seems to be the powerful group right now. And this is the more Christian fundamentalism. They have a very narrow idea of what Christianity ought to be. And they want to see that implemented nationwide. And they're also the ones who are saying, well, this is a Christian nation, and it never was.
Right.
You know, it was a nation of Christians.
Right. Well, and yeah. You know, when we say that it's complicated and nuanced, because obviously there are a lot of political and social upheavals and changes going on in Europe that motivated a lot of the people to come here. And as you said, it was very much a corporate kind of thing. Like, you weren't just, you know, freeloading off the land. Like, someone had to give you permission to carve out a plot to some extent. I mean, there were exceptions, but for the most part, you know, the frontier was managed by these European powers, and people got sick of taxes and said, hey, why don't we sort of police ourselves instead of being policed by these people across the pond? And I mean, it's obviously so much more complicated than that, but I appreciate you adding some clarity there, because I, and probably many of the listeners, didn't know the background of the Christian socialism or the social gospel. And I'm curious, in that, you know, post-Civil War Reconstruction era, was this maybe one of the major factors for this way of thinking? Was this motivating people? Obviously, huge losses in the Civil War, destruction, tons of racial inequality, people fleeing from the South still to get to the North. Were these some of the factors that led people to become more interested in Christianity, whereas in the past they were just focused on eking out a living in this new frontier?
I think in many ways, and I'm not an expert on this, but in many ways, the Civil War was seen in apocalyptic terms. And I think that it probably is not a stretch of the imagination to say that when we look at the United States and the religion, that quite clearly the idea of apocalypse has been running through our national history for a long time. And I think definitely at the end of the Civil War was seen as apocalyptic. You know, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, you know, the battle hymn of the Republic. And when the Civil War ended and people were trying to make sense of what had happened, and again, this is, you know, a complex issue, I think this is also a point where you started seeing some of the splits. Like I said, there's really two kind of apocalyptic approaches. And again, I'm going to get these wrong, but there's premillennialism and postmillennialism. I have a friend who could explain them. We do a monthly podcast, The Cocktail Apocalypse, and this has come up, and she's always much better at these things than I am. But one of them, like I said before, is that we have to clear out sin in order for Jesus to come back. And then the other one is like, there's just no saving us. So why even bother? Just let Jesus come and wipe it all out and start all over again. So I think that these two strands really started taking root much stronger than they had before the Civil War, after the Civil War. I would say that, you know, also in the cities where you started seeing poverty, a great amount of poverty and sickness, that's where the social gospel was really most relevant. And I've not studied this, but my guess is that the social gospel movement probably would have been more in urban areas than in like agricultural areas, because you're going to see more, you know, from their perspective, wickedness in the urban centers, and we have to fix that. We have to take care of that, and it's up to us to, you know, fix poverty. It's up to us to fix sin, as it were.
Right.
And like I said, you know, prohibition was part of this, so it doesn't have, you know, it's not perfect because they saw alcohol as a source of sin, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating how America has this obsession culturally with the apocalypse. I mean, we've seen it rear its head several times just in the past 50 years. The 2012, there's the Y2K, and I'm sure plenty of other, you know, smaller versions of it, whether it was just a cult that believed it or the news that, you know, entertained it. It's something that Americans are uniquely interested in. And I wonder, in a sort of, you know, ironic twist of fate, if this is where environmentalism sort of got its foothold too, in a sense, because it is very much a response to the Industrial Revolution and the nuclear age, which in itself you could think of as an extension of that apocalyptic type of thinking, this notion that we need to go and police the rest of the world. Or, I mean, it gets even darker and deeper than that, depending on who you ask. But I think, you know, there's something tying that in, where this instinct, this impulse, this anxiety about our earth is sort of side by side with this, you know, very over brash, braggadocious sort of, you know, capitalism almost feels cliche because it's more than that. It's really corporatism unchecked, right? And
yeah,
it seems like environmentalism is uniquely American in that sense. And I'm curious, you know, because that seems to be more in line with your focus. Yeah, what are your thoughts on the philosophy of environmentalism, and is it getting lost in politics?
Yes, I think to some extent. I do think that the environmental movement has its roots in the United States. I would not necessarily say that the roots of American environmentalism is apocalyptic. It is religious, though, but more of a mystical kind of religion to large extent. You know, we think of Emerson and his essay on nature, where he has this experience of being the, you know, all-seeing eyeball, right? Like a universal consciousness, if you will. And we can also look at folks like John Muir. And Muir, of course, is the person largely responsible for our national parks. And there was this conversation at the time, because a lot of Americans, you know, our ideas of nature have changed, and there's always been a religious aspect to it. So it's connected to this idea of wilderness, and wilderness has a lot of biblical context. You know, it's where Adam and Eve were sent after the fall. And it was a place where you could get morally confused. And it was this idea of where demons lived, you know, dark forces. And that was still largely present in the colonial period. There's a great film you may have seen at The Witch, which I think taps into that. So Dave Edgars is the director, and it really kind of taps into that idea that the wilderness, you know, that space beyond where people live, is a dark place and a dangerous place. Now, there were a few people who had some different visions. So, for example, Jonathan Edwards, who's considered like probably one of the most important American theologians, he was the person involved with the First Great Awakening. And he's mostly known by his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And yet he had that, you know, is full of, you know, hellfire and brimstone. But he had this image of God, loving God at the center of all creation, pouring forth his love into everything. And so that's when we start seeing people thinking about the natural world as an expression of God, as an expression of divinity. Muir also used that language. And in between Edwards and Muir, you know, you've got, again, that Western expansion where people weren't necessarily seeing the wild as a dark place, and they weren't necessarily seeing it as a place of God's love. They were seeing it as timber, you know, to make a profit. Just cut the trees down. That's, you know, there wasn't really anything special about it. But it was John Muir who kind of pulled us back to that idea of going out into wild spaces to have these experiences of the divine. When you read Muir, you know, it just runs throughout his writings. You know, he often uses the word glory like all the time, and multiple times on almost every page. Glory, glory, glory. Holy, holy, holy. That's how he's describing. And he used that to get people, to get Americans interested in nature. So the reason that we have these natural, you know, these national parks and preserve these spaces, one of them was because he tapped into our religious sentiments. And so a lot of people now, we don't even think about it. that will go out to, you know, go to the mountains to hike or camp, and we see it as a spiritual activity often. That was kind of created by Mirror. Before him, not a lot of people had that idea. So I would say that American environmentalism has its roots in that. It has become more apocalyptic, though. And I think that in Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, at one point, he even refers to some scenario as like walking through the book of Revelations. And I think that what happened is that we have a tendency to think in terms of religious terminology. Even if we're not religious, that terminology is there. And this idea of an apocalypse, and this is a very specific idea of apocalypse that really gets away from the true meaning of the word. It's this idea of apocalypse as like end of the world, right? That's not what apocalypse means. Apocalypse is revelation. Apocalypse is an unveiling. It is a opening up of God's vision, if you will. But yet we use this language, and I think it's double-sided sword, right? That on one hand, it's useful to get people thinking about how bad the environmental situation is, the environmental crises that we find ourselves in, and that has been ongoing for the past 60, 70 years. But at the other side is that it sometimes leads to environmentalists being overwrought and their message getting lost because people will say, yeah, you're just fear-mongering at that point. So does it serve a purpose, this apocalyptic language, in terms of our environment? Maybe, maybe. But my concern is that it just turns too many people off. Mm. But I would say that it is apocalyptic in the sense of an unveiling, as a coming out of darkness and seeing what really is going on. And I think that's what we're called to do, is to see what's actually happening environmentally in front of us.
Well said, Ivory. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors. First and foremost, Above Phone. Get Above Phone now to stay ahead of the curve and stamp out this surveillance state. Big tech is not our friend, and they are selling out your private data and information to who knows where and what. To take back your control and put privacy in the palm of your hands with Above Phone and their line of phones, tablets, and laptops. That's right, no more spying, no more surveillance. Do your thing in the comfort of your own private tech space with Above Phone. Go to abovephone.com/crazy to save at checkout. And listen to my interview with the founder of Above Phone, Hakeem Anwar, who joined me on the show not too long ago. Big shout out to them. And next up, my favorite sponsor, BrainSupreme.co. I'm telling you folks, Brain Supreme is the number one microdosing solution. And if you're curious about microdosing, give it a shot with Brain Supreme. Their products are above all the competitors. I mean, this is the top shelf, top shelf ingredients sourced from the best. So look no further. If you're curious about microdosing, go to brainsupreme.co/crazy and save at checkout. And we'll be right back to this conversation after this break. Our dynamic ads. Remember, every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast gets released early, ad-free, with bonus episodes as well, all on an exclusive RSS feed that you can plug in to whatever podcast app you prefer to use. So what are you waiting for? Sign up and support the show at patreon.com/mftic and never skip another ad break again. Spring has finally sprung, and Hims is here to help you men spring into action this season in the bedroom. That's right, Hims has changed men's healthcare by providing you with access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Okay, don't deal with ED and all the discomfort associated with it alone. ED is not your friend, but Hims is now, and they've got your back. Hims provides a range of doctor-trusted ED treatments like chewable tablets, Viagra, and Cialis, and their generics for up to 95% less. The process is 100% online. Just fill out an intake form on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free. No insurance needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. So start your free online visit today at hims.com/crazy. That's hims.com/crazy. HIMS.com/crazy for your personalized ED treatments. hims.com/crazy.
The featured products include compounded products which are not approved nor verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality by the FDA. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information. Prices vary based on product and subscription plan.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you about my favorite new sponsor. That's Mood. I love Mood because they're providing affordable, accessible, convenient, and transparent cannabis that's 100% legal and grown on small, pesticide-free American farms. That's right, American cannabis for American listeners. And it's 100% legal. They've got a full selection of cannabis products. I was a huge fan of their Tangy flower. Wow, it really brought me back to when I had first tried Tangy, and it was incredible. So if you have any doubts, try Mood for yourself, and I doubt you'll be disappointed. Use the promo code CRAZY and get 20% off your first order at mood.com. That's 100% federally legal cannabis, pesticide-free, delivered directly to your front door in a discreet package. Mood.com, promo code CRAZY, and trust me, folks, you're going to love this stuff. I give it the Mystic Mark guarantee. And Mood is going to back that up because not only do they stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you get 20% off your first order with promo code CRAZY. Well said. I really appreciate that understanding. And yeah, I think that is, you know, maybe if we were more biblically literate in our little, you know, modern public worlds, we would know and maybe use the term Armageddon instead. But yeah, it does serve that function as well, because we need to wake up. And I mean, we can sit here and point to plenty of extinct species that were alive only decades ago. So there are real consequences, and you know, in just that alone, you know, I just went to a Birds of Prey show at a state park near me this past weekend, and it was really neat to learn about some of the wildlife we have in the area. And one of the things that I didn't know was that dead trees are full of life. And you know, most people, if they have a dead tree on their property, they think of it as a threat to their home and they cut it down, remove it. But when you do that, you're eliminating all this, you know, basically real estate for our feathered and furry creatures. So yeah, it's really important. And I think there is something, you know, really deep about that frontier spirit that America has embraced still to this day that connects us to the land. And maybe because also we were outside of the ire of the Catholic Church for so long, these alternative, you know, interpretations of Christianity were allowed to flourish. Whereas in Europe, I mean, there was how many wars fought over these sorts of conflicts and how many sects of Christianity that were essentially, you know, massacred by different governments or political factions of the church. And yeah, it's a real shame that we don't have those strains still preserved in a mainstream way. But here in the States, you know, when it comes to the Great Awakening, there were other movements that followed it. I can think of the Transcendentalists. You mentioned Emerson, of course, he's a famous Transcendentalist. The other movement we've talked a bit about on the show is spiritualism, which is definitely more metaphysical. And I'm curious, you know, what are your thoughts on this and where that plays into the psyche of America? Because nowadays, when we think of ghosts, we think of Halloween. We don't necessarily think of our ancestors like maybe our, you know, predecessors would, the people we inherited this land from, the Native Americans who are still very much alive and well. One of my dad's good friends is Native American, so, you know, my whole life I've known Native Americans, but you know, it being in New England, that's not a common thing. It might be more common in the Midwest, but yeah, what are your thoughts on spiritualism and how that's sort of folded itself into the layers of America?
Yeah, good question. I don't know how well I can answer that. From my perspective, I think that, you know, spiritualism, there's no mistake the timing of it after the Civil War, you know, when it emerged. And I think it was after the Civil War that people really were hoping to have communications with those who lost their lives during the war. And I think that, you know, it was just the zeitgeist at the time. It did open up strains within the American religious spiritual traditions. And I think that now what we're seeing is a kind of the modern version of spiritualism would be things like channeling. There's another name for it, I forget, that we hear a lot now. Mediumship. Mediumship.
The Long Island medium and the television psychics, yeah.
Yeah. So it's still very popular. My approach, and this is an ongoing interest for me, and I would say that it was one of the things that got me started in religious studies in large part is, you know, as a kid, I was deeply fascinated with things like the paranormal, and I still am. And I think that what has happened is that, you know, there's this scientific perspective, right? That's just not possible. Right. And it's like, but I, you know, personally reject that because of experiences that I've had. And I know that these things are possible. And it has been, there's been a lot of research. I don't know if you've ever had like Dean Radin on your show.
I'd like to have him on. I have one of his books, but yeah, no, Real Magic, I think, is one of his books that I have. Yeah. It's a great book.
Yeah. And he shows that, you know, there is something to psychic phenomena, and, you know, that's a little bit different than ghosts. And I have something else I'm going to make a note here I want to say about the ghost for what you said, but I'll come back to it. I think that these things, what they're doing is they're challenging the Western materialist paradigm. And it needs to be challenged. It doesn't help when people just reject it and say that there's no evidence. I always give an example of one of the classes that I've taught has been critical thinking. I teach critical thinking and logic. As part of the critical thinking course, one of the things I was required to do was address pseudoscience, right? And one of the logic books that I have has a chapter on pseudoscience. When it comes to psychic phenomena, be it ESP, telekinesis, telepathy, you name whatever, what the book said was there's just no evidence for it. But yet I know that there is. We have 150 years of history. You know, what emerged out of the spiritualist movement was people beginning to investigate these things. I'm not going to remember it off the top of my head, but the Association for like Psychical Research, and, you know, here and in the UK, and you had people like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and William James and Houdini was involved looking at all of these things. And we've gotten to this point where it is just ideology to say, well, this is not true. And I could not in good conscience stand in front of a classroom and say, there's no evidence for this. This is all just, you know, hogwash and you shouldn't believe it, because I felt like that's just indoctrination. That's just nonsense, because I know better. I think that it's starting to open up a little bit because people are doing some really good research and there are things that have to be answered. And the way I always like to frame this, I mean, this is all part of consciousness, right? This is all part of this idea of consciousness and what's real. You know, these are big metaphysical questions. From a Western materialist perspective, we can't still account for consciousness. It's a mystery. The way I always explain it is, you know, how is it that what's essentially 3 pounds of bacon fat inside of our skulls with some chemicals and electrical discharges, how can all of that working together provide a sense of experience, that there's, you know, that we're having an experience. People watching this or listening to this, they're having an experience. And there's no explanation as to why that soup and bacon fat in our heads would provide for this. It's still a mystery. And yet we have this paradigm of, well, it's all just matter, you know, and the consciousness is a epiphenomena of the brain, so on and so forth. But if you look at Thomas Kuhn's Structures of Scientific Revolutions, he argues that what changes paradigms is always an anomaly. And right now, the anomaly is consciousness. And I think that all of these paranormal things, be it, you know, reincarnation or ghosts or even things like cryptids and all other sorts of things, these are all anomalies to the paradigm. And it is in an attempt to resolve the anomalies that new paradigms are born. And I think that's kind of where we are right now, but it's slow going. It's very, very slow going. And I see it as well in, you know, my field. You know, philosophy is probably a little bit slower to some extent. There are some people who are starting to argue for a idealism. Bernardo Kastrup, for example, is really good at articulating that. From religious studies, we have people like Diana Pasulka and Jeffrey Kripal, who are saying, you know, we need to start taking these things seriously and studying them. And, you know, they're looking at it from the point of view of religion, but at the very least, they're saying there's something to look at here. So I think that all of these things, you know, the stuff that's really interesting and fun is worthy of exploration, because they're going to tell us something about consciousness, the nature of reality, and who we are. And if we don't look at them, we're going to miss out on some very valuable information. So that's what I would say to that extent. Now, I did want to add, this is a little bit of a side thing, because you had mentioned the Native Americans and ghosts and ancestors. The way I see this popping up is in the, I don't know what I want to call it, the trope, I suppose, of ancient Indian burial grounds. because, you know, the whole nation's essentially an ancient Indian burial ground. But we started seeing that, and you see it in some of these ghost shows and whatnot. You know, they'll say, oh, this house is haunted. It was buried, you know, sits on an old ancient Indian burial ground. I think a lot of that is our own guilt. I think that's kind of the source of that trope. Not saying that you can't have some ancient Indian burial ground ghostly activity, but it seems to me that people are a little bit too quick to go to that. But that brings up a lot of interesting questions too. If you find out that your house is on an ancient Indian burial ground and it starts manifesting ghosts or poltergeist activity, where exactly is that coming from? Right. Is it coming from the person in the house, the people in the house, or is it coming from the spirits of the land? And I think that's something we can look at too.
Well, and I'd like to ask, you know, in that situation, would they have experienced it if they weren't prompted with that, you know, history or, you know, myth attached to the land, which in a sense, I don't think that because it's a process of our consciousness that negates it as a reality. I think that actually backs up kind of what you're saying there, is that we're in this conscious co-creation with our reality. I don't know that you've talked to him yet. I didn't see. Maybe you have. I just missed it. But Joshua Cutchin just came out with a really great book called Fourth Wall Phantoms. And it'd be a great topic for you to get into. I'm hoping to get him back on the show to talk about it again now that his book is released. We had him on prior to it coming out, so he really didn't give us any of the juicy details. But from what I've read, I mean, it's really incredible. One of the stories that still stuck with me is that the writer of Conan the Barbarian, the comic book series, he was at a certain point about to give up on writing the Conan comic book series. And late, he had writer's block. It was late into the evening. And he looks over his shoulder and he sees like the glint of a weapon. And he realizes that Conan the Barbarian is standing in the room with him. And he just has this overwhelming sense that like, I'm being threatened to finish this, right? Like the story, I don't remember more of it. There was more to it that really kind of brought it to life. But the idea that an author of fiction could create a physical living character that actually then goes on to interact. I mean, it brings up questions of, are we seeing into the future when we create these kind of things? Are we actually creating them and manifesting them? But nonetheless, Your point, it's very Fortean, and I think that's, again, an American sort of torch that we've lit, and the rest of the world has maybe had it as well and hopefully follows suit. But at least in the Western sort of sector of thinking, we're challenging this materialistic impulse. And I'm really fascinated with where we can prove it. But then again, I also wonder, you know, if our attempts to push consciousness into a scientific method or the experimental method, do we lose sight of it? Do we sort of try to measure a cloud with a cup sort of, you know, like how do we do something like that, you know?
I don't know. It's going to be a challenge. All that I know is that even within any kind of the scientific method, and maybe we're going to have to develop new form of scientific method. But the scientific method, all observations are occurring in consciousness, and that's something that is often just kind of assumed. And I don't know that we should assume that in the sense that we assume it as having no effect on what we're observing. And I don't know that that's what we ought to do. And with what you were saying about Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, that reminds me of the idea of an egregore. And one of the things that I'm fascinated by is the Philip experiment. Have you run across the Philip experiment at all?
I might have, but it doesn't ring a bell at the moment. Could you tell us?
Yeah, it was a group of, I believe they were Canadian, a group of Canadian parapsychologists in the early 70s. And what they did is they made a ghost. And what the approach that they took, if I understand correctly, hopefully I'm getting all this right, is that they created a whole story for this character of Philip, a background story. And the story was that he had fallen in love with this young village girl, but he was married but ended up having an affair. And then the wife found out, and the woman that he was in love with ended up dying. And he was so distraught that he committed suicide. And I think they had this all set like in the 1600s or so. And what they did is they all knew it was fiction. And yet they began holding, I think, weekly seances. And in their weekly seances, they would try to communicate with Philip. A year goes by and they didn't really have a lot of success. But after about a year, things started happening. They started getting knocks to some of their answers. The table that they were using would levitate. Sometimes it would spin around. It would move forcefully across the room. There are videos of this on YouTube. You can look up the Philip experiment and see it in action. And it's fascinating because they made a ghost, I don't know that ghost is the correct terminology for it, but they made something. And it seems like they did that with group intention.
Right.
And, I know that Dean Radin talks a lot about group intention, that it can have a profound effect on the world. So our understanding of what's real is still, I don't want to say necessarily in its infancy, but it's a lot more than what we think it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've heard the term tulpa, and that kind seems to fit, if we're going to look for an accurate term for that. But it's fascinating to think that, however many people, I think there's a study power of eight people can focus their intentions and manifest something with success rate that is statistically, it qualifies it as actually occurring and not just coincidence. Mm-hmm. And it's really fascinating. But you alluded to you having a paranormal experience of some kind. Would you mind telling us about that?
I've had a few.
Okay.
excuse me. So I've lived in two haunted apartments. The first one was my last apartment in Denver before I moved to California for a while. And there, my bedroom was like in a loft, and I was reading a book one evening, and all of a sudden my bed starts shaking like someone is at the end, just kind of going like that. And it woke me up once doing that. And I spoke to, there were four apartments. It was an old Victorian house that had four apartments in it. And it turns out that other people had experiences in the house as well. So I had that. And then my very first apartment in Los Angeles was also haunted. That one was in an old hotel. I was right off of Wilshire and Fairfax. So really well-known sort of intersection in Los Angeles area. Catty corner from the Los Angeles County Museum of Arts, just a few blocks away from the tar pits. And it was odd because I always felt like I could never keep that apartment clean. I had a few things that would vanish on me, and then like car keys or remote control. And I would just start saying things like, you know, can I have it back? And they would appear eventually. There was one evening I was sitting on my couch watching television, and to my right was a small hallway that would lead to my bedroom. And there was a closet, and the closet didn't have a door. And one of my cats was sitting in front of this closet opening, just howling her head off. And, you know, I looked over and I'm like, Cochran, just shut up. And all of a sudden there was a, it's an old 35 millimeter camera in a bag, and it had been in the closet for a very long time. I mean, it had been there for several months, no problem. All of a sudden it just jettisoned out like it had been thrown at the cat. It did not just tumble. It was jettisoned out. One morning I saw a hand coming out of my closet, as I was lying in bed, just waiting to start my day. I occasionally have sleep paralysis, and I was having one of those, moments, and I felt this being on me, on my chest, which is a common experience for people who have sleep paralysis. And the whatever it was got right into my face and just screamed, I'm here. And that woke me up really quickly. One evening I was sitting outside having a glass of wine and a cigarette. This is when I still smoked. I quit many, many years ago. And one of my neighbors came out and another couple were going in. And as they crossed paths, they started talking, and I overheard that they all were sharing their experiences. So I got onto the conversation, and it turns out one apartment at the very front of the building, they could not keep people in. They would last maybe 2 or 3 months, and then they would leave because the activity there was so bad. When I found another apartment after leaving that one, I remember walking into this new apartment, and it just felt like this weight had been lifted off of me. So I had those. I've had precognitive dreams. Probably the experience that I cannot explain, that I'm still trying to figure out what in the world was going on, was a couple years ago, probably 2022, I think. I had come back to Denver, and I was in a weird headspace. Things in California weren't working out for me all that well. And I was seriously considering moving back to Colorado. And I had this mantra that came to me a few months before during a mushroom ceremony. And when I left Denver, I always like to take back roads. And I love Southern Colorado, especially down in the San Luis Valley, where there's a lot of activity down there. And I stayed at this hot springs. And at the hot springs, they have a labyrinth. So I was walking this labyrinth, just repeating my mantra over and over and over. And then it was very close to the name of the city. It always escapes me. It'll come to me. There's a little village there that is very odd, not Keystone, Crestone, Colorado. There's a Hindu ashram there. So I stopped there and I did some work karma. I loaded up some boxes from the bottom of the hill to come up to the top of the hill. When I was inside the ashram, I was going to all the various deities and repeating my mantra. there's two Buddhist stupas nearby. So I went to the stupas and I was going, you know, circumambulating the stupa. They had some set kind of prayers to do. So I did those, but then I also threw in my mantra. It's also down by the UFO watchtower, which is this odd little thing that I love to visit sometimes. They claim that there are portals there and people have left objects. So it's like its own little labyrinth. So I went in, I left some offerings and, you know, was repeating my mantra. And I like to just drive around. I don't like to drive on the interstates as much as I can. And I don't use GPS often. I still like the old physical map because that'll give you a lot of the back roads. And I had left my Atlas in California. So I realized that no one sells atlases anymore at gas stations. But I did find one little map about Native American sites in New Mexico. And they had some sites with the petroglyphs. One of them was Chaco Canyon. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go to Chaco Canyon. So I go down to Chaco Canyon and I camp there. And there had been this thunderstorm that had been following me out of Denver and it followed me into New Mexico. And one of the things that I really wanted was just to see the sky. Chaco Canyon is a park where there's no lights at night. So you can see the Milky Way. And that's all I want. I just wanted to see the night sky. But the storm was coming. And I'm like, damn it. So I go in the tent and, you know, the tent's kind of like shaking about because of the wind and everything. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to see the stars. But after a few hours, everything calmed down. And I looked out the little flap and I could see a few little pinpricks of light. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna check this out. So I sat up and I started putting on my shoes. And all of a sudden, I heard a woman's voice. Nick. And I kind of sat there for a minute and I'm like, yes, hello. Nothing. And I said, okay, well, I'm listening. If you have anything you want to tell me, I'm listening. So I go out and sure enough, I can see the stars. And I dragged this like chase lounge with me. So I had that set up. So I was just like lying there, you know, looking at the stars for a few hours. And I decided that, you know, after a few hours, I needed to get some rest because I was going to have to leave pretty early. So I go in and I fall asleep for a few hours. And then I wake up because I have to go to the bathroom. And it was still dark. And like I said, there were no lights. And I'm like, oh, do I want to go to the bathroom? Can I wait? I'm like, well, if I wait, I'm not going to get any sleep. So, I mean, I'm kind of going that back and forth. And finally, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go. So I start putting my shoes on. And this time I heard a man's voice. Hey, Nick. And again, I'm like, hello? There wasn't anyone around me. To this day, I have no idea. I have zero notion of what that was, who those voices were. But that was probably one of my more profound sort of paranormal experiences, I would say.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah, I think there are these portal places, power places where the veil is thin and we can interact with them in certain ways. And yeah, it's so fascinating to think that there's this whole landscape of Native American spiritual sites that for the most part, unless the tribe is still there in that region, they're largely forgotten. Yeah. You know, there are certain exceptions, but in my own state, Connecticut, you know, one of the oldest states in the union, you'd think everything would have been sorted through in the, you know, however many years. And there's a giant stone boulder that by all appearance to me looks like a swan or some sort of bird. Yeah. And it's just standing there on another boulder and I've never seen any writing about it, but it seems like it's adjusted or aligned rather to where the sun sets in the equinox, the fall equinox, and or maybe whenever it was positioned at that time period. I'm definitely not an archaeoastronomer, someone equipped to do those kind of measurements, but yeah, it's something that I think has really gone, you know, overlooked and undervalued. And if we can connect to that through nature and this incredible heritage we've been given with the national parks. You said that was in New Mexico, that site that you were at?
Yeah. It's Chaco Canyon. Speaking of the solstices, it's one you've probably seen this on a documentary somewhere, but it's one on the, I think it's on the spring equinox maybe, where there's this light hits in this one room and there's like a dagger that will appear and it goes through this like spiral. You can't get to that. That's closed off, but that is there. There are ruins and it's amazing because you can walk through the ruins of this civilization that had been there. It's connected with the Anasazi. Excuse me if I slaughter that. There's a really interesting history there. And all throughout New Mexico, I find New Mexico a place where, I don't know if you've ever been, but it's like as soon as you go into New Mexico, you can feel it. There's a spirit to the land. That I can't quite explain, but it's there. There's just something. And New Mexico is mostly empty space and reservations. You know, you have a few cities like Santa Fe and Albuquerque and Las Cruces. And, you know, there's, you know, little small ones here and there. But it's a magical place. And Southern Colorado as well. There's a, I forget what line it is. There's a, one of the parallels goes through there where I've heard people say that there's a lot of paranormal activity along that. Yeah. Along there. Southern Colorado used to be where there were the cattle mutilations back in the 70s or so, maybe 80s. I don't know if there've been any recently. But yeah, there's some weird stuff down there. It's different energy. It's a very different energy.
Well, I'll say as someone who's mainly stayed most of my life in New England, I've never been to New Mexico, but I have been to Colorado back in 2016. Me and a couple friends did sort of a legal cannabis pilgrimage when it was still illegal everywhere else. We went to Colorado and my buddy had a job lined up after college. So we kind of sent him off. We drove him there and helped him, you know, move in. But yeah, it was really incredible being in that, you know, space. And I definitely felt a different energy when I was in Colorado. Yeah. I don't think I would be doing this podcast if I didn't have some of those experiences out there, because it was so foreign from what I would kind of used to out here in New England. We have sort of more of a witchy vibe, you know, and out there, there was this bookstore, maybe you're familiar with it. It's called The Shining Lotus. It's been around for a while. I was just really blown away as a book lover. I went in there and I probably took home like 10 or 15 books thinking like, well, when's the next time I'm going to be here, you know? So yeah, it was quite a pilgrimage for me. And I really have a reverence for the Rocky Mountains after being able to go out there. And I think it was June and we drove far up into the mountains that we were in the snow. And I was just like, wow, this is incredible. So yeah, it's all, I guess, perspective and the grass is greener. But seeing as you grew up out there, are there any places in Colorado that you think are, I mean, you mentioned the cattle mutilations, but you know, we hear a lot about the Denver airport and all the conspiracies with that. But are there any particular, I don't know, portal places or areas of high strangeness that people may not know about if you're not from Colorado?
I think mostly it's going to be in Southern Colorado. I think the people would know about some of the more famous ones, like the Stanley Hotel, which was the inspiration for The Shining.
Right.
And you can go and do tours there. I don't know if, Estes Park, where it's located, would be a portal or not. I used to work in a very small town, near Colorado Springs. It was just to the west of Colorado Springs, Manitou. And Manitou Springs is the official name. And there's something there. And I don't know of any paranormal activity there, but I know that it draws artistic people. It draws artists there. And it's a small community, like 2,000 people. But it's just phenomenal in terms of the artistic energy that's there. Yeah, I don't know of any other places here that it would be like portals. Mostly it's Southern Colorado, which is where a lot of the strange stuff happens.
Yeah. Now, Manitou, are you familiar with the meaning of that word? And is that commonly spirit. Familiar there? Like, is that something that you kind of see when you're there, like on the billboards stuff?
Yeah, I think they know it. Okay, yeah, cool. I think they know it, yeah.
That's so fascinating because that word, I wasn't really familiar with it until I started kind of appreciating the history here in New England and seeing that there are certain stones that have been left behind called Manitou stones. And generally they're shaped like a man, like almost or human. They have like a head and shoulders, and they're typically in sacred spaces where there are other stone structures, typically, you know, graves as well. But yeah, it's something that I think I've heard of Manitou Springs, but I used to do a podcast called Esoteric America, and I'm thinking of bringing it back because there are so many small towns and little areas of the states and Alaska and Hawaii as well, any other territory. I mean, there's so many little stories and pieces of strange history that when you start looking for it, it wants to be found. These stories want to be told, you know. And one of the stories that recently really struck me that isn't so close to the States, but I guess technically maybe not anymore, but at one point in time, the Solomon Islands was considered a U.S. territory, maybe before the World War when Philippines was still a colony. But yeah, the Solomon Islands have a crazy, interesting history, and I found this book called The Solomon Islands Mysteries, and it's all about these giants and how over there in the Solomon Islands, the villagers and people who've been living there for thousands of years, it's like as commonplace as we would think of as bears and birds and there are these giants. I mean, you can think of it in American terms as Bigfoot or Sasquatch, but to them, they have a whole history of tribal warfare with these beings that make you wonder, like, are these actually, you know, beasts, or are they lost, you know, human, you know, cousins and long, long ago in the evolutionary chain, you know, they just disappeared from main areas because of wars and such, but in these very small isolated areas they could maybe eke out a existence alongside certain groups of people. But I know that's totally out of left field from the Colorado topic, but you know, it's not often we do podcaster to podcaster conversation, so I figured I would bring that up. But
Well, we have Bigfoot here too, so.
Right, right. Of course, well, Colorado for sure, more so than where I'm at in Connecticut, although there are some rare here and there sightings in Connecticut. But I wanted to shift the focus before we wrap up on one of the articles you have on or blogs that you have on your site about Terrence McKenna, somebody who's definitely near and dear to this podcast. We talk about him every now and then. I've used some of his sound bites and intros and such. He's got tons of relevant commentary on things that are still being talked about today. But you wrote about how there's this sort of overlooked Buddhism in Terrence McKenna's work and the impression he left. Talk to me about that, because we hear a lot about, you know, the psychedelics and all the different kind of strange beings and things that people see. He was kind of a pioneer in that sense as far as DMT and things that are still kind of taboo now. And yeah, I'm curious because you kind of alluded to that before with your points about, you know, people in the 60s turning towards Eastern's, you know, mysticism to make sense of these psychedelic experiences. So yeah, what is the Buddhist McKenna?
Yeah. I wrote that a long time ago, like 12 years ago.
Oh gosh. So
yeah, a lot of it I don't necessarily remember.
That's fine.
The main sticking point for me, or what really jumped out at me, was McKenna would often talk about the felt presence of immediate experience. And I found that to be kind of inherently Buddhist in many ways. You know, you would hear, and it's also from not exclusively Buddhist. I know that Ram Dass, you know, be here now, this idea of focusing on the present moment. But, you know, with McKenna, I think that there was also a ecological strain with him that is also very consistent with Buddhism. And if I remember right, at some point he did talk about Indra's net, which is this analogy that's often, I don't know if it came out of Buddhism, but Indra was a Vedic god, but Indra's net is this image of reality that there are all these jewels. You know, just imagine there's this net, this cosmic net, and at each node of the net, there's this jewel. And that jewel is reflecting all the others. And so it's used to demonstrate the interconnectedness of all things. And I think that's something that McKenna would agree with, this sort of interconnection to things and that felt presence. I don't remember what else. I'm sure that there was more in the writings. You'll have to forgive me. I just don't remember.
That's fine.
Yeah. It's been a very long time.
I should have looked. It might have said that on the website there, the date. But yeah, it's something that I think we've talked about on the show, particularly because of, well, you sort of touched on it, which is the present moment. You know, it's why I close each podcast saying immerse yourself in the moment, wherever you are in the now, because I like to be reminded. I think the audience may like the reminder that's what we're in. I mean, the past is the past. The future is the future. We have only this ever present now. And I think keeping your consciousness there allows for whatever communication it is with the other. That's what I like to say. I know some people might have a more superstitious idea of mysticism, but to me, I think it's something that's in line with the creator. It's in line with morals. It's something that we all as human beings have access to, sort of spiritual connectivity to the world around us. And messages, ideas, thoughts, emotions can come to us in this sort of way if we're open to it. And I get that sense from talking to you that you sort of share in that. And it's been a really pleasureful conversation. I really appreciate getting to know you, Nick. And aside from Rebel Spirit Radio, which people can find wherever they're listening to this podcast and on YouTube as well, is there anything else that you have to promote or anything you'd like to leave the audience with?
No, I'm working on a few things. I'm trying to set up some courses, but that's slow going. And like I said, I'm thinking about taking the podcast in some different directions. I've got a couple videos that I've filmed interviews. One is on Stan Grof, and I did another one on Ralph Metzner. But that's slow going. I'm still in the process of writing the script to try to put those together. But when they're done, I'll get them on the YouTube channel. And I'm trying to start doing some more writing again, but it's been slow going. But classes just ended for me, so once I get done grading, I'll have much more time to do some more writing.
Right on. Well, I look forward to keeping up with your work and glad to make the connection. We definitely have to connect again in the future. Yeah. So I'll stay updated with what you have going on. And until next time, folks, thank you all for tuning in. And until next episode, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. And there it was, our conversation with host of Rebel Spirit Radio, Nick Mather. Big shout out to him. He's interviewed several of the guests that we've had on this show and plenty others that I hopefully will be able to get in touch with. Maybe Nick can help out with that. If you've got a guest that you'd like to see me interview on this show, the best way to get in touch with me is on Instagram at My Family Thinks I'm Crazy. All one word, no spaces or characters, special characters. It's all just one word, My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, on Instagram, or mftic podcast@gmail.com. That is another surefire way to get in touch with me. I can't always get back to every single message because I've surprisingly been getting messages quite frequently, and it's not always easy to follow up because of the various jobs that I do with other podcasters like Sam Tripoli and Danny Polichuk, and then of course keeping up with all the things to do for this podcast. So if you feel it in your heart that this show has impacted your life or made your day, made your life better in some way, even a small way, send us a one-time donation and get a shout out here on the podcast. Big shout out to Nate Shavoya of the Reality Czars podcast. Good friend, really great guy. He is a hell of a podcaster, and he's really kind. Sends a $5 donation here and there every now and then, and I appreciate it. So shout out to Nate Shavoya, long overdue. Shout out to my man. He does Reality Czars with our friend Thomas, the Paranoid American. Another shout out. Shout out to Thomas. Hopefully I'll get back on his show. I think this month we're going to be doing another show together. So yeah, sign up on Patreon. That's the best way to support the show. The one-time donations get you a shout out, but if you want to ensure that this podcast stays on the air, sign up on Patreon, patreon.com/MFTIC, and we've got $2 tiers, $3 tiers. That'll get you pretty much just the ad-free version of the show, plus some bonus episodes. But if you want the most bang for your buck, the $8 tier or the $5 tier are the best tiers. You get the video version of the show, you get the early releases and all that good stuff, bonus episodes, Illuminati Confirmed, Finding Falconelli, these shows I do with Juan Ayala and a bunch of other really interesting people who join me for bonus content, which I will be doing more of starting this year. So the goal has been set and we are on our way to accomplishing that. I just pretty much finished piecing together the mobile studio, all the equipment at least. The physical location, well, that doesn't exist. It's a mobile studio. It goes wherever I need to go. But I have all the pieces to essentially record a podcast anywhere, with or without Wi-Fi. So that's great. We're going to be turning the dial and getting into the field for some in-person interviews. So support the Patreon if you'd like to see that sooner than later. And until next episode, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. MFTIC. It's all the sugar. Yeah. It's all the sugar.
broadcasting the moon matrix from the lunar surface. They want you confused, like you never knew your purpose. Hopping through the portals, dismantling the machine. My family thinks I'm crazy, I can't believe what I've seen. Memories of a war, the Pleiadians and Anunnaki. Stuck within the genes of a copy of a human body. DNA fractal, the universe within me. Epiphanies of science is hoarded by the Illuminati. Puppet masters know the power of the mantra. Repeating mad lies till it has an effect on ya. Subliminal messages hijack your perception. Tricking the population with holographic projections. We see through it, and the system is unraveling. I'm astral traveling through the library of the Vatican. On a sacred journey, I embark with the squad. Forever spitting truth like Mark on the pod. Gotta know the facts, never hold back, cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. Dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers, searching through the galaxy. You might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade. I awoke in a deep underground military base. Zero recollection of how I got to this place. Alien corpses floating in glass cylinders. Must have been extracted when they crashed into us. Animal hybrids contained in the cages. A lion with the eagle head. Monkeys with reptilian faces. Losing my mind and I'm feeling desperate. I look around the room and I see no sign of an exit. All of a sudden the wall flickers away, revealing a hangar full of spacecraft. My getaway, I run to the nearest one. See a guard, knock him out, robbing for his plasma gun. Hop in the ship, take the controls. They highly intuitive, I figure it out easily. Lift off, accelerate through a tunnel until I see the light. Fly into the sky, get flanked by six F-35s. Gotta know the facts, never hold back, cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers, searching through the galaxy. You might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade.